Today, we're going to talk to a person who has done the impossible in the wine world. Alex Gamble not only moved to Burgundy as an American, but he was able to buy vineyards and make wine in what is probably the most exclusive wine region in the world. And he's written a book about it called Climbing the Vines in Burgundy. It's a story of hard work, of perseverance, and positivity that is truly engaging and somewhat unbelievable. And we'll discuss it with him. Hello, and welcome to the Wine Pair Podcast. I'm Joe, your sommelier of a reasonably priced wine, and for this special episode, I am on my own, as my wine pairing partner in crime, Carmela, is busy making cakes for her Baby Cakes Micro Bakery, which, by the way, you can learn more about if you head over to our website, lovebabycakes.com. But now, as a quick orientation to our podcast, what we usually do in each episode is learn about, taste, and review three wines that are reasonably priced, which means under $20, and should be easy to find. However, for this special set of episodes, what we do is we interview people who are involved in actually making wine. Sometimes, like today, those wines don't necessarily fall into the reasonably priced range, but that's okay, because part of what we want to do with our podcast is to educate ourselves and you on different aspects of wine knowledge in a fun, entertaining, and unstuffy way, and even maybe a fun and entertaining way, as Decanter Magazine has called our podcast. And that's what we're doing today. And then a small plug before we get into this interview with Alex Gamble, which, by the way, is spelled G-A-M-B-A-L, and then we talk about his book, Climbing the Vines in Burgundy. If you like what you're hearing or are interested in hearing our other regular episodes, please subscribe to our podcast so you can hear more, especially since you're only getting one half of the Wine Pair podcast in this episode. And you can also go to our website to send us a note or subscribe to our newsletter at thewinepairpodcast.com, and you can follow us at Instagram at the Wine Pair Podcast. And if you like what you're listening to, then you can leave us a nice rating and review. But anyway, let's get on to the interview with Alex Gamble. Hello, Alex, and welcome to the Wine Pair Podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's going to be fun.
Oh, you bet. So for all our listeners, we have a really special treat. We're joined today by Alex Gamble, who is the owner of 30 acres of Grand Cru Vineyard in France, something I think Chardonnay lovers will really appreciate. And he's written a book about how this American was able to be successful in a place that's not very open to foreigners. So again, thank you for joining us, Alex.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So I am super excited to learn more, but I thought maybe we'd start out just with you telling us a little bit about your background, your family, et cetera, and then we can talk about your wine adventure as part of that.
Absolutely. Well, the first thing, I wish I had owned 30 acres of Grand Cru. I owned 30 acres of various crus in Burgundy and a very small amount of Grand Cru. And we'll talk a little bit about that. But just for the record, I mean, if I had owned 30 acres of Grand Cru, I wouldn't have sold. But so my background is a little, it's kind of wacky when it comes to wine. I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area in Alexandria, Northern Virginia, and had a kind of normal upbringing with my mother cooking for a bunch of boys and girls that were coming through all the time. And ended up after 4 years at the University of North Carolina, and then I taught school for a year, I started working in the family business, which was a parking lot and garage company and real estate development company that my father and his business partner had started after the Second World War, kind of a just a classic post-World War II GI success story. My dad was from Scranton, Pennsylvania, actually Old Forge, Scranton, Pennsylvania, up near where Joe Biden is from. So it was coal mining country. And his partner, we were basically the Russians, the Russian Orthodox, how we grew up. And my dad's partner was from Syracuse and Polish. So just kind of a classic story, post-World War II story. And in the, I started working for the company in 1980. And in the mid to late 80s, I started getting interested in wine. I had children young, got married young, and basically went to the wine stores in D.C., which were always very, I don't say we were progressive, but because of D.C.'s peculiar wine laws, it allowed the retailers actually to import wine and distribute it. So there was always a number of of foreign, you know, European old world wines, if you will, as well as a lot of new world wines that were kind of up and coming. So it was a great place to learn. And instead of going to bars and nightclubs, my wife and I, we had babies. So I went and picked up bottles of wine. We came home and cooked for ourselves and for our friends. And that's how it got started.
Got it. So you just started falling in love with wine from that?
Yeah, well, I grew up with wine on the table. Nothing special. We always had, I think, Mouton Cadet, red and white, and some kind of red from Italy. And then, you know, occasionally you'd have Lancers. You'd see that, which was basically sparkling rosé. And that was my wine experiences. And but I did do a little bit in college, tasted a bit of wine, and was around around people who were interested in food and wine. And I think I was always, I don't want to say I was a gourmand, but I was always, I love good food. I have a bon appetit, as they say. I mean, I rarely, rarely refuse a meal, and I have a good metabolism. So I've always enjoyed food and interested in it. And just by, as I joke in the book and say, by pure dumb luck, when I got more and more into wine and we would have wine tastings at our house and have friends over, I could remember what I tasted and what I had with the meal, what meal I had with the wine. And I just got, it became more and more of a passion. And it basically transformed me from an avocation to a vocation.
Got it. So let's talk a little bit more about that. But one thing I did want to just call out, because you talk about this in the book and you just talked about it now, is, you know, this connection with food and wine. And so I think that's something we'll talk about, because it's something that we talk about a lot on our podcast, is this, how food and wine are really meant to be together. But we'll get to that in a second. So as you said, you went from a wine lover to a wine, that being your job. How did that happen?
Well, in the late early 90s, I'm 66, and I don't know if some of the younger people didn't have to go through the savings and loan crisis. This was the first big, well, one of the big financial wrecks in the early 90s. And we were in a bunch of real estate deals, and a lot of our partners were unable to make their obligations. So we had to make good on their obligations. And it was a very uncomfortable time doing what we call workouts, basically trying to figure out how to pay the banks back. And I'm doing this in my early 30s, and it was not very pleasant, to put it mildly. And so my wife and I, and I've been beginning to think about trying to do something different. And my wife and I said, you know, I wonder if we could live in Europe for a year. Let's take a break. Let's take a sabbatical. It was my business partner taking a sabbatical and gone and got a master's in real estate at MIT. And while interesting, I go, that sounds kind of boring to me. I'd rather be in Europe or do something fun with the family. And so through a local wine store, we explored this idea. And we went to France in March of 92 and met this woman, Becky Wasserman, a very famous and pioneering woman in the wine trade in Burgundy. And she needed some help because a lot of her clients had stiffed her during the same real estate recession. And I went over, well, we went over and met her, and she said, you know, would you like, I said, would you like a couple of helpers? She said, sure. And you'd be a stagiaire or an apprentice, which she normally has when their kids are in their early 20s as they're getting out of college. And we said, how would you like to have two old ones with two kids? And she said, why not? And my wife was a graphic designer. And so she was working with some on marketing for the company, and I was working on the financing and sales. And her company had, you know, she discovered many, many great winemakers in Burgundy. And many of these winemakers were all basically my age. I got there, I was 36 years old. So we were all baby boomers taking over. They were taking over from their parents and all had kids my children's age. So it was just a perfect fit, kind of natural fit, as we arrived into this world where we were the only Americans. And when I was working for a well-known and reputable operation, and it kind of went from there.
So I know this is something you talk about in the book as well, but was it challenging to go there? Because Burgundy is no joke. You know, that's a very substantial wine area. how did they take to you as an American?
It's a really good question. I think the first thing to understand is, since I wasn't a winemaker, I had no opinions. Okay. I think that's the first thing. And I was mostly used to French wines. And because I was working with Becky and selling their wines and becoming friends with them, that was one piece. And I always say the real secret weapon was going there and having our kids in the local schools. I mean, they went to the local Catholic school for the 4 years. They were bilingual in 5 or 6 months, got great grades. And many of their friends' parents are winemakers. And it's no different than, you know, when as we have children in the United States, wherever you live, your life is centered around your children's lives and usually their friends and their friends' parents. So between birthday parties, Christmas, Easter, end of the year school barbecues, marriages, funerals, athletic events, a lot of soccer games and horse events and things of that nature, you meet people and you find out, oh, this person has this domain here, or this person is supplies all the bottles, or this person supplies the equipment. And I built that up over 30 years and they became my friends because of the kids. And now 30 years later, I mean, my children are 38 and 41. Basically their friends are now making the wine and running the domains as I did 30 years ago. As I arrived with their parents 30 years ago. So it was a very, in the big O sense, big organic sense that we were in country, also the only Americans, and we were integrated. And Burgundy is this big B. People think of it, it's this huge, it's one of the icons of wine in the world. But from a size standpoint, it's tiny. And, if we lived in a village of the first year of about 100 people, when we moved to Bone, there are about 20,000 people in Bone. It's not big. The kids walk to school. You see people. So I think it's the size of it and the intimacy of it and having the kids and living, if you will, in situ, in country, that made the difference.
I love that. I love that. It was the kids, it was the family, the ability to sort of bond with other families that kind of brought you in or helped you find a place. What was the hardest part about getting started or hanging in there? Like what were the challenges that you faced?
Well, so when I started the business, I worked for Becky for 3 years and then I went to the wine school for a year, which was also another important piece. That I don't want to fail to mention, because so many, virtually all the winemakers of my generation had gone to some kind of school, and many in this, it's kind of a 1 year junior college program or 1 year post college, post grad program. You come out and you can run a domain, and it's really a generalist. We know just enough of chemistry and all these kinds of things to be dangerous, if you will. The hardest part, when I started, it was relatively easy to find good grapes. And I hasten to use the word bulk wine. We say wine en vrac, basically wine that's been fermented and it's in barrels. So Burgundy is kind of a wacky operation where many of these very well-known domains have small amounts of land in very important vineyards. And a lot of domains that no one ever hears about. And so there's a very large business that's conducted by brokers putting together these small producers, their product, whether it's grapes or just fermented wine, with a secondary market, what we call the négociants. And anywhere else in the world, just winemakers. So you're basically selling the grapes to a person like myself. And it was relatively easy in 97, till about 2004, 2005. And for a variety of reasons, it became much more difficult to find those grapes. So finding the good quality product in the beginning was not the problem. The problem is trying to create a brand and sell the stuff. And so I got, relatively very good scores, my 99s, my 1999 vintage, my second year really making wine. They were all 90 plus wines, but it still was difficult to sell. I mean, it took me a long time to sell those wines because I didn't have a brand. Nobody knew me. And it was, you know, pounding the pavement. And I talk a lot about this in the book, the constraints and obstacles that exist in trying to sell wine, not just in the United States, everywhere. That was the hard part. There was a very good retailer in New York called who owned the Burgundy Wine Company, Al Hotchkin, the late Al Hotchkin. And he told me early on, Alex, I have no doubt you're going to make really good wine. Your problem is, your goal, your biggest issue is, how are you going to sell it? And he bought my first 50 cases. And he was right. I mean, so, you know, you make this stuff, you got to sell it, and then you've got to get paid for it. Because every 12 months you have another vintage and you can't skip a vintage. So that was the real challenge. And that takes a long time and a lot of capital.
And then what was your breakthrough? Was that your breakthrough? Or how did you get over that hump? Because that's a significant hump.
I would say around 2005, 2006. So, you know, 7 years into it, 8 years into it. Finally, sales were pretty much even with the new wine coming in. I always tell the story, you know, when you do an advertisement, they say it takes, you know, 11 to 12 ads to for the product actually to stick in someone's mind. And I would say for those first 5 or 6 years, twice a year, I'd be in the Wine Spectator or Parker or in the French Revue de Vin de France, and, you know, great scores, people love them. But it wasn't until about 6 or 7 years, 11, 12, 13 times people had seen my name that I existed. And my friends in the art world and music world tell me the same thing. It takes a long time to get that traction. And, you know, the real issue is, can you hang in there long enough? And that's, you know, I talk a lot about that, you know, how I did that. And, you know, the proverbial shake and bake, just keep the machine alive to fight another day, so to speak.
Yeah. It's like your breakthrough was hard work. It's like, I don't know what the exact line is, but like, I was an overnight success. It just took me, you know, 12 years to get there.
That's it. It's you have to persevere. And, I was fortunate that I had very, you know, great friends and business partners who, you know, invested with me initially in the business and then in the vineyards, and, you know, lent me money and, you know, allowed the thing to kind of just, you know, fits and starts, you know, kind of bump along until it finally kind of worked. But then at the end is when as you've read, you know, we now have new challenges. That was one of the several challenges. One of the reasons I decided to sell, but that's another conversation, maybe later on.
Well, actually, let's go, because you when you started out, you were operating as a négociant, right?
Correct.
You were buying grapes from other vineyards, and then you actually became an owner of vineyards. Like, how did that happen? Did that, you know, why did you move to that, you know, way of doing things? And how did that change the business?
So what I was seeing, what was happening, was that there were, starting in 2005, 2006, it was harder and harder to get good grapes, because what was happening is that there were many more new micro négociants, I mean, small winemakers starting off making 50, 60 barrels. And then in addition, a lot of the winemakers who I was buying grapes from were now putting everything in bottle and becoming négociants themselves. So for years, I was buying their grapes, in essence, financing their growth and basically being their bank and getting eventually cut out. And I saw this was what was happening. So you had not only these new, you know, independent négociants, but these small domains that might be buying in, you know, 30 barrels a year. But there were something like 300 new négociants in a 5 to 7 year period. These were primarily existing wineries. So it was a huge amount of wine that was getting sucked out of the system. And I felt like I would, if I did not change my operation, basically having control of my own grapes, and keeping that cash flow, if you will, in-house, it would be much, it'd be very, very difficult to grow the business and survive. So in 2005, a friend of mine who worked at the wine school, here's again the question of relationships. She told me her father was retiring and selling his vines. And so I bought about 3 acres of basic Bourgogne Rouge and Bourgogne Blanc, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir in the least interesting areas. It was inexpensive. It was like $100,000. But it allowed me to kind of start. I call it my laboratory, to figure out what does it really cost per acre to farm? How, do I need my own equipment? All those kinds of things. I felt it was a cheap MBA school to learn that. And then once I had that, if you will, I call it Farm Co. setup versus Wine Co., wine company versus farm company. My farm company, I knew over time I'd be able to get much better vineyards. And that happened just 2 years, 2 years later, when I was able to buy some fantastic Chardonnay in Pouligny-Montrachet and Chassagne-Montrachet. And from there, I added each year or every couple of years bits and pieces, so that at the end, I'd say I was 80, 85% full domain. And then what people don't realize is we also would trade a lot of grapes, because I was very long, very rich in Chardonnay. And I had friends in the Côte d'Ivoire, which is all Pinot Noir, who had their own Negociant operations, and they needed grapes. So I would trade my Chardonnay grapes in Pouligny and Saint-Romain and Saint-Aubin, a very, fantastic, some of the best Chardonnay in the world. I would trade those grapes to get things in Chambon-Musigny and Vaughan Romanée and Clos Vougeot. So it was currency. And I also knew that, these winemakers were like me. They were biodynamic, so organic plus. So I was getting really great quality grapes. And didn't worry about, the last nickel or last liter of juice or a pound of grapes that I might or might not get, because the quality was there and they felt the same way. So it's a long question, but that's what's happened over really the last 20 years in Burgundy.
Amazing. It seems so complex, so challenging. And you really did have to sort of build your relationships there to be able to even, be part of that. I'm really curious about how you started farming, because that's a whole different gig than making wine. That's not an insignificant change. Like, how are you able to do that?
Well, initially I would subcontract out the actual plowing and spraying, because with 3 acres, you can't afford it. Doesn't make sense. But then we would do all the work ourselves. So I had a part-timer and a full-time, if you will, caviste winemaker working with me. And they would go out there and do the pruning. And, I'd come out with them in the winter and pull all the cuttings, and we'd burn the cuttings. I mean, I did it. It was not the most pleasant thing. That was definitely a young man's game. I did that early on. And then I started buying some of my own equipment when I got up to, let's say, 5 hectare, which was about 12 acres, something like that. No, about 8 or 9 acres. At that point, I started buying my own equipment. So it was a process, Joe. I think that's the way to look at it. And then at a certain point, in a year like 2012, where it just rained the whole month of May and into June, and we had all kinds of fungal diseases. This is what you learn the hard way. So we basically, Burgundy doesn't seem humid compared to a place like DC I grew up, or St. Louis, or in the Northeast. But it's humid enough that we get mildew, and then odium, which is powdery mildew, which is what all rose lovers bemoan. And when it gets very wet, you have to be out there spraying all the time. And in a year like 2012, we were spraying all the time. You couldn't get the subcontractors to be there on time, especially if you're going to do it bio. And so at that point, that was in 2012, 7 years in having my own really farm. I go, I got to get a tractor. I've got to hire somebody who can do the plowing, and we can do this in a timely manner. So it was a process.
So this adventure is pretty amazing, the sort of twists and turns that it took. What are some things that you learned about yourself in this process? Not just about making wine or those kinds of things, but what surprised you about yourself?
Oh, very good question. I think I knew I was always very resilient, but I think I'm now looking back as I talk about what we did, my resiliency surprises myself. But it's one of those things, Joe, when you're in the battle, you don't think about it. You just got to do it. So, and it's not as if I stepped off, you know, started the business and had to worry about the rain in 2012. I mean, this was a long process learning. And every year we would learn something new. I mean, in 2016, we had frost and I lost 50% of my crop, but 85% of my four or five best vineyards. Now that makes that, you know, you can't sleep well at night when that happens, because you can't replace those grapes. So I think that resiliency and that, and also frankly, my optimism, and I hate to use the word leadership, but optimism with my team, because they would get very down and they were always worried. But I always had to project as the leader and owner, everything's going to work out. Everything's fine. And that is not really a French trait, optimism. But I think they learned that I'd never let them down. Everyone always got their paychecks. I paid back every loan I ever had. So that finally set in. But it took a long time. It was hard. And I had to, you know, as I write in the book a couple times, you know, my employee said, Alex, you know, the bank wants a call on the loan. We're going to go bankrupt. I said, no, we're not. Got to figure it out. I had no idea what I was doing, Joe. But I couldn't let them panic or show them that I was panicking. So I think that's, you know, leadership. And that's what it comes down to. But it's tiring and it's exhausting. And at a certain point, you know, I felt like, okay, I've had enough of it. And it was time to move on.
So let's go there, because I know there's a lot of pieces. So, you know, for our listeners, you need to find the book Climbing the Vines to fill in the gaps. But let's talk about the shift. So you shifted out. Like, why did you move on? What was the impetus for that, and what did you move to after that?
So as I said, in 2016, we had a terrible frost, probably the worst frost since, I don't know, 60, 57, something crazy like that. And, you know, people said, well, what did it mean, Alex? Well, it cost me, you know, 300,000 or 400,000 euros of grapes, which means it's, you know, 800,000 euros of finished wine and bottle. So about $1 million worth of revenue. I mean, that's what it was. And you can't replace it. So as I had built the domain, and I'd bought my friend's domain in 2015. And so my goal had been that by, let's say, 2017, 2018, all that 500,000, if you will, euros worth of, so actually probably closer to 700,000 at the end, worth of euros of grapes, instead of being sent out to third parties where I was buying their grapes, it was staying in house, and I'd basically be self-financing, and it would be a very nice little business kind of running along. Then all of a sudden, you know, we lose this harvest, and you know, and basically what happens is that 2016 vintage, you're selling that in 2018 into 2019, and there's no money coming in unless you have old vintages or big reserves. I mean, it's just pure cash flow. So that was one issue with it. And the other issue I talk about is I'm very aggressive on growing. I wanted to continue to grow the business. And it got to the point it was impossible to buy vines. We were competing with billionaires and multimillionaires and for domains. And I was always very aggressive. And in 2017, a deal came along, perfect vineyards for us. And we had two other great winemakers. We were going to divide it up. It was a great business plan. And my top number was, like, I think 10 million euros. It's a lot of money, crazy money. And we were going to divide it up and get our own capital to do it. And then We actually, my young chief financial officer and kind of general manager, he said, let's go to 11. I said, oh, whatever. And it ended up going for 13 to an heiress of one of the big grocery store chains. So 30% more than my top number. I go, I can't compete. I mean, this is getting wacky. And then, you know, thirdly, I thought about, I'm turning 60. I was 61. And I'm going, you know, and I don't have any children interested in the business. And finally, my wife in 2018, we discovered she had stage 4 colon cancer that had spread to her liver. So I think all those things together I just felt the business had been good. The economy was good. It was time to sell. It was time. The market was strong. I had a product, vineyards that people wanted, and I felt I could, you know, do well by selling. And it was just the right time for me. So I made the decision and turned the key and haven't looked back.
I appreciate that. And I appreciate your vulnerability and openness to talk about these items. So you left, but you weren't done. So you've been doing a few things since you left. One is you wrote this fabulous book, Climbing the Vines, and you're still making wines today. So what's this latest chapter of Alex Gamble's life been?
Well, as I write in the book, you know, idle hands, idle minds, you get into trouble. So one of my dear friends and business partners is from Santa Barbara, and we were trying to do, we weren't selling enough wine in California, so we thought maybe we'll do some marketing. And I ended up meeting one of his old clients who has a winery, Peter Work, Ampelos Vineyards in Santa Barbara. And the next thing you know, we are digging holes and said, let's make a little wine. So we did this in 2016, 17, and 18, found some very good vineyards, very good grapes. Our fourth partner actually has a vineyard company, he's virtually planted all the vines in Santa Barbara for the last 40 years. So we got great grapes and made several spectacular Chardonnay and Pinot Noirs. As one of my partners says, in the Gamble style, not necessarily Burgundian, but I literally shipped over my barrels. I didn't want the barrels to get that the Californians buy. I shipped over my new tanks that I used exactly the same protocol that I do in France. And I actually last night I had a couple cases of my 2016 Chardonnay I made and gave it to a benefit, and we had it. I was the bartender. It was fun, and the wine is spectacular. It's very Burgundian, and you know it's not high in alcohol. When we picked, everyone thought I was crazy, and I said, no, don't worry about, you know, the numbers. How do the grapes look, and how are we going to make it, and what do we want to make? And so it's a very different approach in California. And if you will, new world, it's a numbers oriented approach rather than saying, all right, what do we want to do? And let's just make it and let the numbers take care of themselves. So we did this for 3 years. And in 2018, the last year we did it, my partner, Peter at Ampelos, he got ill with pancreatitis. He recovered, but I had to do everything and fly back to Jackson Hole for one of my wife's maybe 35th chemo treatment. Then back to Santa Barbara, then back to France. And I go, that's enough. So selling the last 100 cases of wine, I'd love to sell somebody some of the Gamble Work wine from California. It was a fun project. But again, as I mentioned earlier, the hardest part is developing a sales system, a distribution system, a brand. And honestly, none of us at our ages, we didn't want to work that hard to go on the road to create a new brand. So we've been selling everything directly. It's worked out fine. Have we made any real money? No, but we're getting our money out. And we kind of proved that we could make a whole different style of California Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. The reality is that that's not what the market wants and is used to, but it's something we wanted to do, and we're proud of that. And in the meantime, I'm here in the Tetons. I still have my home in France. I go back a couple times a year. Not as much as I thought I would. I'm kind of reinvented myself here. I'm in the winter. I work as a host on the mountain in Jackson Hole. Basically, I describe it as a JV ski patrol. And people say, oh, Alex, it's just, you know, you're living the dream. And I go, you know what? I worked 40 years so I could be a ski bum, and I'm proud at that point.
I will say you've lived, from my perspective, you've lived several dreams. I know it always hasn't been easy, and you've had some setbacks and some tragedies in your life. But, you know, to be able to work in Burgundy and come back and work in skis, you know, in ski slopes, you know, it's pretty fabulous. You've lived an amazing life, and it's a testament to you. And I loved what you had to say about, you know, going through the tough times. It's when you look back on it now, you're sort of amazed by it. But in the heat of the moment, you were just driving. You're just driving and going and just making things work. So that's amazing.
Well, and that's it. You just have to go. What was it? Satchel Paige, the great African American pitcher in the old Negro leagues. And he was a real funny comedian. He said, "Remember, just keep running. Don't look back. Something might be catching up to you."
That's right.
And that's kind of my attitude. And now what I've done, I have a couple real estate projects. We've built some, relatively speaking, affordable housing apartments in Jackson. And then now on the other side, I live on the Idaho side, the western slope of the Tetons, in this wonderful farming community that's growing very quickly. I'm building a new house out of an old barn. And the house that was on site was what I call the Brady Bunch, a classic 1970s ranch house, 5,000 square feet. It had been recently redone. And I gave it to the city of Driggs, and we literally lifted it up, cut into three pieces, moved it, and we're going to create a daycare center for 50, 60 kids. And so I've got plenty of projects. And, you know, so I'm doing different things. I'm as busy as ever. If anything, I joke and say, my projects are getting in the way of my recreation. But, you know, my daughter lives here. I have a grandson who now is almost 10 months old. She teaches in the school system. So she's excited that there'll be a daycare center. Heck, she might even work there. So, you know, it's been good. I mean, I'm in a new phase of my life, as busy as ever. And I'm very fortunate. Got some great friends, and still have some great friends in France. I'm going back in 2 weeks. I'll be there for about 6 weeks. I've been buying barrels of wine from the hospice the last couple of years to benefit the foundation I set up for my late wife, who was a mogul skier, a freestyle skier. So I've got a lot of fun, different things I'm doing now. People talk about getting retired. I don't like the R word. I call it, I like the P word, projects. I have new projects, just different things that I'm doing.
That's fantastic. I love it. Well, in a minute, we'll talk a little bit more about how people can find you and find the book. But we often, you know, we kind of like turn at this point in the interview to talk about Sunday night dinner. So I know in your book, you focus not just on wine, but wine and food and wine and people. I know that's a big part. So clearly, you know, having meals with others, breaking bread, building relationships, et cetera, is an important part of for you. It's an important part of your life. It's an important part of our family as well. So my wife and I, we come from an Italian American background, and Sunday night dinner is a thing. You know, we do every Sunday night. We have dinner as a big family, and it's loud. And so you're invited, Alex. You're invited.
I can't wait. I'm ready. I'm in.
You're not that far away. We're in Seattle. You're, you know, Idaho-ish. It's not that far. I mean, no. You know, it's a drive.
It's doable.
So when you come, or when we go and visit you in the Tetons, when we go to Jackson, we visit you, we're going to serve, you know, we'll make the food, but you're going to do the wine. Now,
I want plenty of bottles. This is not a problem.
Okay. So that's my question. My question is, what wines, and we're going to have probably Italian food, but what wines, would you serve? And are any of these wines your own wines?
Good question.
And maybe it's memories. It's wines of memories.
Yeah. So, you know, with Italian food, you know, Pinot Noir, especially from Burgundy, is you're getting more acidities. And I hate to use the word light, but more elegance. So most Italian food is going to be a little too big and savory for most Burgundies. So I'm a big Rhone fan from the Valley of the Rhone, And over the years, I used to have a lot of Southern Rhones, but my tastes have changed because I don't like the high alcohol level. I'm a lightweight. I mean, I can drink my, you know, 12 to 13% wines all night long, but I get these 14, 15, 16% stuff. I can't do it. So what I love are the Northern Rhones, basically Syrah, from Hermitage, Crow's Hermitage, Saint-Joseph. And those wines still have enough elegance and enough, if you will, grapiness to stand up to Italian and kind of very savory, flavorful foods. But what I love about the wines from the Northern Rhone that make them so interesting for me is, and this is what I talk about a lot in the book also about Burgundy and why there's the Pinot Noir and Chardonnay from Burgundy is so different, is I focus on texture. You know, what's the mouthfeel? What do the tannins feel like? I mean, what's the whole expression? I mean, is what kind of music is it? What kind of buildings? What kind of personality does that wine have? And for me, something from the Northern Rhone with Italian food has enough personality to stand up to the food and, if you will, dance well with the food without either being dominated by the food or dominating the food, either way. And that to me is, and I talk about it in the book, so much of I mean, for me, wine is all about balance. Is it balanced? Is there enough acidity? Is it balanced also in the context of the vintage? Because a balanced wine from 2018 is a very different animal than a balanced wine from 2017 in Burgundy. And that's where, when you get into the aesthetics of wine and really understand that difference between a 2017 and 2018, then it makes sense. The problem is most wines that we buy that are on the shelves in the grocery store are very well made and can be very delicious. But I find a lot of them are not balanced. They tend to have higher alcohols, have some residual sugar. You know, they'll give me a headache the next day. But, you know, Americans especially love, you know, they say they don't like sugar. They love sugar. And that is why, wines primarily from the old world and not in super hot areas. I mean, I don't want to just pick on American wines because the wines from the southern part of France now, I can't drink either. I mean, I literally have to put water in it because just the alcohol is too high. So, but again, for me, it's balance, you know, is that wine balanced by the food? And is the food balanced by the wine? That is what it's about for me.
Well, Alex, you're speaking my language. I love the way that you talk about wine. And we talk about this on the podcast quite a bit, but we use an inelegant term. We say that a lot of American wines or the American style is a punch you in the face wine. Like,
oh, absolutely.
It doesn't have any subtlety. It's meant to be sort of a flavor bomb. I talked to another winemaker from Stoller Wines, Alex Weichold, and we talked about, you know, wines being almost cocktails in yes. America rather than meant to be with food or this balance or elegance or austerity. And it's interesting too, because I think the American palate is not often finds those European types of wines to be underwhelming.
Absolutely.
But you and I would have a good time drinking these wines.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, the French term is digeste, as in digestion. Mm-hmm. So is the wine digest? Can you digest it? You know, how does it work with the food? You don't want that fruit bomb just to sit there and all of a sudden, bam, you're high.
Mm-hmm.
I'll admit, as I said earlier, I'm a lightweight. I don't like that heavy stuff. I was talking to someone earlier today, and we were talking about these high alcohol wines. You know, when I started getting into wine in the mid 80s, I mean, 16% was port. And you'd have one glass, maybe two sips, small little glasses of port. Now, so many wines are like that with the residual sugar. And, you know, it's a good business, but it's not good wine. It's nothing I want to drink. And, you know, people have made fortunes. What's the old joke? You make wine for the masses, you drink with the classes. You make wine for the classes, you drink with the masses. And it's about volume. It's about size. You know, it's everything that is against the wines that I like to drink and the food I like to eat. So It's not that it's right or wrong. It's just different. And I choose not to, as I say in my old age.
Yeah, I'm with you. 100% with you. Okay, Alex, before we go, I want to make sure that people have an opportunity to, they need to find you. They need to read your book. I don't know if you're doing any tours or anything, but let's tell the folks out there in listening land, as we like to say, how they can find you and buy your book.
Well, it's easy. You can go to climbingthevines.com. That will have all the basic information. You can obviously buy the book online through Amazon or Barnes & Noble. I would love to get some of these books in some of the independent bookshops, but it's a very difficult business, the distribution business of books. It's even worse than the wine business. And then if you want to send me an email to find out more about the Santa Barbara wines, just go to gamblework.com. And if you want to send me an email just for more information and have a conversation, it's alex.gamble@icloud.com. And it's G-A-M-B-A-L. I learned to have to spell my name when I was a kid. No one ever spelled it right.
That's awesome. And I will have I'll have this information in our show notes for our listeners to find, and we'll spell it out after our interview as well. But Alex, it's been a total pleasure.
I can't believe we've been talking 15 minutes already. That was fun.
No, it's great. And, you know, I just, again, just really appreciate your openness and just your willingness to talk through all of these items with us. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure talking to you. And, you know, if you're ever, if I'm in Seattle, I'm coming to your house.
You better.
If you're out here, come out. And if you're ever in France and Burgundy, let me know. I'm currently renting my house out on a weekly basis. It's a great pad. Or if you want to just come for a couple of days in Burgundy and I'm there, I'll take you around and we'll do some tastings. And it's great. Actually, now I'm a civilian. I can be a tourist again. It's good fun.
Well, I love it. You should be careful, because I'll probably take you up on that.
It'll be great fun. Thanks
awesome.
So much.
Thank you, Alex. Really appreciate it.
Have a good weekend. Appreciate it.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our interview with Alex Gamble, winemaker and now author. And just in case you're worried about memorizing all of this stuff, don't worry. You can find out all of this information on our website, thewinepairpodcast.com. What you do is you just go to the website, you look for the show, you click on the show, you scroll down and you find the show notes for this episode. And there you can find all sorts of links, which I'll tell you about right now. You can find Alex's book on the web at climbingthevines.com. And you can also find Alex on Instagram at Alex Gamble. And again, his last name is G-A-M-B-A-L. You can find him on LinkedIn if you look for his name, Alex Gamble. And then you can also find him on Facebook at alex.gamble. And we hope you'll check out the book. We hope you'll send Alex a line. And we also hope you'll subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at thewinepairpodcast.com and reach out to us and join our newsletter. And then maybe also reach out to me and Carmela at joe@thewinepairpodcast.com if you want more information or if you just want to hang out and chat. We look forward to hearing from you. But for now, it's time to go. And as we like to say, life is short, so stop drinking shitty wine.
Bye-bye.
Too much, always drink too much, always pray too much, always pray too much. And when I'm with you too much, I fall in love too much. And when I'm away too much.